Since man discovered agriculture, the rise and fall of civilizations has ultimately been about food. That's the premise of a new book titled Empires of Food, Feast, Famine, and the Rise and Fall of Civilization, written by Evan Fraser and Andrew Remus and published by Free Press. Good morning. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of WPR. During the next 56 minutes or so, we're going to find out about how food, economics, agriculture, and human empires are all related. Joining me by phone this morning are the co-authors of this work. Andrew Remus currently serves as managing editor at The Improper Bostonian and was a staff writer and associate editor at Boston Magazine. Good morning to you and thanks for being on the program today.
Good morning, John.
Also joining me this morning is Evan Fraser, associate professor of geography at the University of Guelph in Ontario, Canada. Good morning to you, Professor, and thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Your book talks about food empires. Empires of Food is the title. I suppose we'd better start out by defining what that is. Professor Fraser, why don't we start with you?
Well, whenever you see something happen like a city form, that city has to be fed somehow. And the inclination is to start growing food in farther and farther, ever more efficient locations until you get these extremely complicated systems where food is produced, stored, and transported into cities from a huge geographic region. And we see this from Rome, we see this in Imperial Britain, and we see, of course, this exact same phenomenon today. And so it's that series of links that crisscross huge geographic areas and keep urbanites like you and me fed that we are calling a food empire.
So when men were, the humankind was scratching out its existence at the edge of the glaciers, we weren't shipping food from here to there. We were catching it as we could and living in whatever way we could. But once we got, once the climate became a little more amenable to the growing of crops, we were able to expand the population and organize ourselves into cities. Would that be kind of a fair statement?
Well, you're close, but it was actually, we have no idea how agriculture started because we don't have any historic records. But the suspicion is actually agriculture started when the climate got worse. And when the climate was nice for hunting and gathering, and people could sustain themselves at a relatively nicely by picking berries and hunting the odd gazelle or whatever, that was good. But it was probably during a drying of the environment, specifically in sub-Saharan Africa, that drew people into more concentrated locations where they came into competition with each other and had to then, therefore, settle down and start establishing farms. So in all likelihood, agriculture was actually probably a response to a piece of bad climate change, not a response to a better environment.
Now, there are a lot of examples throughout history, and you describe these in your book about what happens to civilizations when the food runs out, when something happens, when the climate changes, when the population grows beyond its capability to produce food, the soil dries up or gets used up or something else happens. You have a number of examples of what goes on and how disastrous that is. And you draw, what's the parallel between those instances that you cite and what we're seeing in on the earth today? And Evan, I want you to get in on this as well. Or Andrew, I'm sorry, I want you to get in on this as well. In fact, why don't you start?
Okay, sure. Well, one of the simplest examples that we looked at, which is a good way to think about how food empires expand and contract, was the case of medieval Europe. And that was a situation where you had a relatively forested wilderness, which people made inroads into, particularly the monastic groups, chopped down forests, set up arable land, planted crops, built roads, and then traded them over distances. And as those networks got more complex, the farms spread out into increasingly rough territory, increasingly hilly territory, and caused a lot of soil erosion over a period of centuries. So even as more and more people were being supported by these networks, they were in fact undermining the very environment on which they were based, which led after a number of hundreds of years to loss of food productivity and then dearth and some pretty rough times. So that is a very simple model. Now, if we take that and look, keeping that in mind, looking at our food empire today, We seem to have overcome a lot of those problems. We seem to have overcome the idea of overusing the soil because now we have miraculous inputs. We have miraculous fertilizers and super plants that can that are extremely productive and can be can feed a lot more people than the old traditional forms. But in a way, and what we argue in the book, is that we have traded the old dependencies on the soil and water for new ones, which haven't made us any more independent. They just made us more dependent on fossil fuels, on our water supply, as always. But they haven't increased our stability. They've just increased our productivity.
And what's really interesting, just to jump in and add a little bit to what Andrew just said, what's really interesting about the rise and fall of the medieval society in Western Europe in the 12, 1300s is that the Europeans in the 11 and 1200s grew this enormous population during a period of time when the climate was relatively good. The growing season was long. It was relatively easy to get crops off. However, starting in the 1300s and moving into the 14 and 1500s, the climate got a lot worse, and so the yields just declined due to a problem in climate change. And so one of the lessons there is that this population had grown accustomed to the yields that came off of good seasons and was unable to adapt to the fact that the seasons didn't remain good in the long term.
Yeah, the so-called Little Ice Age that hit Europe in that time. What was you also cite some examples from this side of the Atlantic, the Mayan culture, for example. Talk about them for a little bit.
Andrew, do you want to handle this one, or do you want me to talk to it?
Why don't you jump in, Evan?
Okay, fair enough. Well, I mean, the interesting thing about the Mayans is, again, they developed a advanced, complex society with an enormous amount of sophistication in terms of arts and culture and science, based around very large cities that were fed by a very large hinterland, a very large remote areas that would produce the corn that would be shipped into the cities. Now, in doing so, they cleared the tropical jungle of the Yucatan Peninsula and replaced it almost entirely with cornfields. At about the time that we know archaeologically the cities were abandoned, that period of point in history also coincides with some very, very bad droughts. And we know this by studying the sediment of the ocean just off of the Yucatan Peninsula. And scientists can take sort of cores from the bottom of the ocean and look at the kinds of minerals that are dissolved in the bottom of the ocean. It's kind of like looking at a tree ring. And in years when there's a lot of rain, you've got lots of dissolvable minerals that have been washed out of the highlands. And in years where there's not much rain, you don't have many of these minerals. And so they're able to identify that the years when the Mayan civilization collapsed and the cities were more or less abandoned coincided with periods of very, very serious drought. And the argument there is that the Mayans exposed themselves to cleared the jungle, created a system that was highly prone to erosion, couldn't trap much water in these highly eroded soils, and then when the droughts came, the yields were no longer sufficient to keep the cities fed, and people just retreated back into the wilderness, and the cities were ultimately more or less abandoned.
Your book opens with a description of the Three Gorges Dam in China and what that's doing both to agriculture and the population over there. And of course, recently we've been seeing stories in the news about massive flooding in China and both people being killed there and obviously displaced. What's the significance of that dam and the development of the food industry in China?
You want to take that one, Andrew?
Andrew, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I can start off on that. Well, I mean, China has had a very long history of controlling its water supply. It goes back to ancient times where they have irrigated their fields off of the main rivers in the country and developed their agriculture based around the rivers. The Three Gorges Dam is one of the most monolithic attempts to control the waters that's obviously ever been attempted by humankind. Evan actually was the one who traveled through it and can speak for the monstrous size of it and the almost the idea of human engineering as an element of geography being so big. But these engineering projects can't change some of the fundamental problems that we face with agriculture and which China will continue to face. They can redistribute water, they can attempt to control things, but still haven't been able to get over our dependency on the basic needs of having a useful water supply and of being able to control the way that it's delivered. And Evan, if you want to hop in and tell about your visit to the Three Gorges Dam, you might be able to speak about how...
I mean, the Three Gorges Dam has three key functions. One is to produce energy, which is fair enough. One is to control flood water, which is fair enough as long as it works. And there's some engineering reports saying that it actually will increase the likelihood of a catastrophic flood, although will decrease the likelihood of a small flood. But also to provide irrigation to farmers. And this is what is particularly interesting in terms of food, because to produce these extremely productive, high-yielding, genetically modified crops that are increasingly common world over, it's not that we've broken the old boundaries of nature. These super productive crops need a huge amount of water and a huge amount of nitrogen in particular to grow so large. And so China is re-engineering its entire country's water system from the very south, which is quite a humid, wet area, all the way to the north. And there's the Three Gorges Dam is actually part of what's called the South-North Water Transfer Project, which is a series of enormous canals designed to take water up to the north where they produce a lot of wheat. And that's because to remain food secure, China is absolutely depending on extremely highly productive seeds, which needs these enormous amounts of water. However, all this water creates serious problems of soil erosion. And so as the soil erodes, it is actually then less able to trap water, hold on to water, so the whole system becomes more drought-prone. And so in many ways, the Three Gorges Dam, although it is a short-term fix, is actually exacerbating the underlying unsustainability of the system, increasing the likelihood of a catastrophic failure at some point in the future.
I just saw a news story yesterday that China is buying a rather large amount of wheat from Canada this year.
Yes. Interesting.
Yeah.
So for the last 30 years, scholars have been concerned, or maybe concerned is too strong a word. Some scholars have been outrightly panicked. Some people have been interested in what China will do when it starts buying wheat and rice and corn off of the international market. And the expectation was that China would never, a country with that huge population, that little amount of land, would never be able to feed itself. Now, thanks to things like the Three Gorges Dam and super seeds, China has done an extremely good job at maintaining its food security, is almost entirely independent. But this year, things started to change, which is really interesting. So about 3 weeks ago, the Chinese government announced it was going to double its imports of Canadian wheat. And so maybe this is the first sign of things to come. And the reason China's buying all this wheat is there's been a terrible drought all across eastern Asia this year. Russian wheat yields are down, Vietnamese rice yields are down, Chinese wheat yields are down. And so China is turning to the international market to buy food. Now, it is a sufficiently rich country that it could upend things, and it is a sufficiently populous country that it could upend things. So it'll be very interesting to see how this plays out, and we are at a very interesting juncture of history where we're going to determine whether or not in the global world food trade is indeed the recipe for food security, or is it indeed going to drag us all down into a very uncomfortable and hungry future.
We're talking about the new book, Empires of Food, Feast, Famine, and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. We're fortunate enough to have both of the co-authors of this book on the radio this morning, Evan Fraser and Andrew Remus. Your questions for them are welcome. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can send an email to talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And you can go on Facebook, find the Kathleen Dunn fan page, and leave a comment there, and we will convert that into the radio broadcast. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. 10:22, you're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. Here's what's coming up a little bit later on today. After one on Talk of the Nation, Tony Cox guest hosts a Rocky Mountain High edition of The Political Junkie. That's after one today. This hour, we're talking about the book, Empires of Food. Don't put that "the" in front of it. It's Empires of Food, Feast, Famine, and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. We have both authors with us this morning, Evan Fraser and Andrew Remus. We were talking just before the break. You know, it seems to me we were the path we were headed on was one. If you look historically, civilizations and empires of food, you might say, were separated from one another. They were in individual places. We can talk about Europe. We can talk about Asia. We can talk about what happened in Central America, or this place or that place. It seems to me that what you're aiming for here is that now we sort of have this one big empire of food, and it's the whole Earth. Is that would that be a fair assessment, Professor Fraser?
Age a few minutes ago, and in the absolute trough of the Little Ice Age, when the crops were really, really suffering, was the mid-1600s. And that was precisely the point when Europe really started aggressively colonizing the New World. And so the New World really provided a safety valve for Europe in terms of its extra population, but also in terms of its a source of resources and a lot of food. However, we don't have that buffer anymore. The Little Ice Age itself was probably mostly a Eurasian phenomenon. There's not much evidence that it affected the Southern Hemisphere too badly. But today, we don't have another continent to exploit. And in all likelihood, the sensible science suggests that climate change is real and is a global phenomenon. So we are now in a very tightly interconnected boat that has very little in the way of buffers or surplus reserves, or extra cupboards full of stuff that we can turn to in times of need.
Andrew, talk a little bit about Francesco Carletti. Who was he, and why did you include his story in your book? What does he illustrate?
Well, Francesco Carletti was—he's really the hero of our book. He's the figure that ties the entire narrative together. And he was a 16th-century merchant, originally from Florence, who at a young age began one of history's least successful business trips. He circumnavigated the globe over a period of about 15 years. And during that period, he traveled from Italy to Spain to Cape Verde and then off to South America, saw the Spanish colonies in the Americas, tasted the foodstuffs traded there, and carried on into the Philippines, Japan, China, and India. So he was one of history's first global commercial travelers. He made the whole circuit, and he recorded how these disparate civilizations were producing, consuming, and trading food. It was a subject that he was particularly interested in. And for us, he was an interesting figure, largely because he was at the cusp of this, or he traveled the world as Europe was beginning its tremendous colonialization project. And his reactions to these disparate cultures were very often ones of wonder. What are they consuming? And but also, how can I make a buck off of it? So he saw the world as his own, I suppose, commercial. He saw it for its commercial possibilities. And he followed a transportation network that was truly global for the first time. So it was a precursor to what we're seeing today to a large degree.
And many of his observations are amazingly modern. I mean, he was a man with an extraordinary sense of humor, I think. His diary is very, very funny to read. And he was observing the price of things here, and he was observing soil degradation and deforestation there, and he was observing local customs, and he got amazed by chocolate and potatoes. He was one of the first Europeans to record accounts of chocolate and potatoes and things like this. And even so, all his text, his diaries come across as extremely modern feeling. And so it's just interesting that for Andrew and I, that at the birth of the modern world, you see somebody with a very modern sensibility discussing very modern set of issues, which again reinforced to us that the 20th and 21st century are not unique. The circumstances we find ourselves in with trade, with food, with environmental degradation, with globalization. These are not unique phenomena. We might think that they're unique and that we represent an exceptional point in history. But really, I think Carletti's diary for me illustrates the fact that many of these things have been around for as long as civilization has been with us.
Well, one of the one of his first stops was in Cape Verde, in the islands off the coast of Africa, which were some of Europe's earlier colonies. And even when he arrived there, he already saw well in effect the environmental degradation that had come about as a result of clearing the forests and planting sugarcane on the islands. It really deforested much of the landscape and caused a large amount of environmental ruin. So already a lot of the themes that we return to over and over in the book were already very visible to him right at that point.
We have full phone lines, as I expected, and we should start taking calls because people want to talk, and I need to let them. Nathaniel in Milwaukee, you'll be first. Nathaniel, good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for having me. I was going to mention that, and I'm sure somebody else is probably going to bring up this issue, that I see potential food crises is not so much an argument that we have overpopulation, but question of really if we have good management or not. Because somebody, I believe, said they thought that when we see a suburb, we assume the food productions move someplace where it's more efficient. Being from the Milwaukee area, when I see a suburb, I think historically that was very good farmland, and basically we, due to economics rather than a need for food, booted the farmer off and put in suburbs so we don't use basically what we can use to make food. And we do that with a number of things. And I'm not one of these people who's a global warming denier, but when you talk about the growing size of the population, we're actually going to hit a certain number and then, as by most projections, stabilize, and people don't talk about that, where if we can actually figure out how to feed that many people, we actually could take care of things for a good period of time on out. So I see, and by the way, I'd like to thank you for pointing out some interesting things, because I do think that it's interesting to consider the potential damages of what we do and what people are not necessarily thinking about.
Nathaniel, thanks for the call. Who would like to respond to that? Andrew?
Well, yes, indeed. The population from the world population is projected to hit about the number of 9 billion within the next 40 years or so. And yes, that really is not the elephant in the room, but the big question facing us is, will we be able to feed 9 billion people 40 years hence, considering climate change, considering the questions of water supply and fossil fuels? And certainly land use is a massive part of that. One of the modern food empire that we have is built around these big areas of specialized crops in the prairies, these vast seas of monocultures, which grow single strains of particular crops and then ship them over large distances to population centers, while we continue to build suburbs around our cities and use up land that used to be local farms that might have supplied neighborhoods with their eggs and their meat, but now these things have obviously become centralized and shipped over long distances, and that is really the crux of the problem that we're facing, because that model is full of instability. Evan, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, well, I mean, we've created over the last 50 years, we've created an extremely economically efficient system, where very little labor, very little in the way of cash inputs, go into producing an enormous quantity of food. What we haven't created is a very resilient or robust system. And so while the climate is good and the soils are fertile, that's not creating an economically efficient system may not be a terrible idea. However, my concern is that as we look forward to this enormous population growth and the probability of declining yields thanks to climate change, that we won't we'll need to readjust our system. We'll need a more resilient and robust system. And that will cost us money. That will make it more expensive to produce food. I think, however, we can take steps now, like greenbelt legislation, protecting local farm legislation, curbing suburban sprawl, curbing big box conglomerations, that will make it easier to create that resilient system that we're going to need 30, 40 years from now.
All right, Nathaniel, thanks for the call. Let's go to Bob, who's on the road, and hear what Bob has to say. Bob, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. My addition to the discussion is that when I taught ecology and environment, so frequently we went to Garrett Hardin's Tragedy of the Commons, and he talked about solutions to problems going from a technical solution to a non-technical solution, meaning that, for example, with population, we had the technique to control population. We had the technologies. We had condoms. We had gels. We had diaphragms. And it took a change in ethics or morals. And this relates to not only population but to agriculture. We've got the technologies to grow the food, but the ethics of what we are destroying and what we're losing, we're not thinking about as much as we should. And the ethics of what we're doing to future generations. And this applies also to last hour's discussion of global warming, in that we're taking agriculture from a biological cycle, and by drawing oil for ammonium nitrates and all the petroleum we use to grow our food, we're demanding so much from the geologic cycle. And so we're drawing oil that's been put into the earth over hundreds of millions of years, and we're going to try to use it up in about two centuries. So hopefully that would help clarify perhaps what we're talking about, too, as far as ethics and the demands that we're putting on all of our cycles.
Bob, thanks for the call. We did spend an hour talking about the ethics of climate change just before this program, so they kind of dovetailed nicely. But, Professor, why don't you respond to Bob first and then Andrew?
Yeah, thanks very much for that, Bob. And I use Garrett Hardin's classic article, The Tragedy of the Commons, in some of my classes that I teach on sustainable agriculture and food systems. And what's interesting about Garrett Hardin, who argued that without private property, we would inevitably exploit resources, is that more recent, probably more sensible scholarship has probably contradicted that. So this year's Nobel Prize winner in economics is a woman named Eleanor Ostrom, who has written a lot about how small communities actually do, over very long periods of time, sustainably manage common pool resources, things that everybody has access to. And it has to do with everyone having a small enough group of people that is sufficiently cohesive to feel a shared collective sense of responsibility. And there's a fair bit of psychology and economics that goes into this research. And so I'm a little scared by Garrett Hardin's conclusions from 35 years ago in his paper that we need private property because that's the only way of maintaining sustainable land management, whereas Eleanor Ostrom's more recent work, like I said, just won a Nobel Prize in economics, suggests that at smaller scales, communities are very successful at managing resources sustainably. Now, that was the first part of your comment. The second part of your comment, I think, had to do with technology. And, yeah, we absolutely have a role for technology to play. We need, you know, in this world of 9 billion people, probably 6 billion of whom will likely live in cities, we can't afford, in my opinion, to be fussy about our technology. Now, that doesn't mean we use technology uncritically. We have to be very careful about our technologies. We also need to be aware that we need labor and labor-based technologies as opposed to just petroleum-based technologies. We need solar-based technologies. You know, we need all the possible energy sources we can use and bring to muster to solve this problem. Because I think the global food crisis, this 9 billion, 6 billion urbanites by the next 50 years will be the problem that probably ends up defining our culture. And climate change is a major component of that challenge.
Andrew Remus, you want to add anything to that?
I would, yes. Food, I think, as the caller very correctly pointed out, does have a very strong ethical element. People think about food not as they might think about other commodities. They have an ingrained idea that food is somehow different because it really is all about our essence, our survival, the very cells in our bodies. And therefore, when food is discussed as a commodity and as something to be conserved or profited from, there's an emotional element that enters that's also affected many people's reactions politically towards agriculture over the centuries. There used to be an old set of laws in England called the Assizes of Bread, which guaranteed certain prices for bread that were separate from the market, because the ruling classes recognized that people obviously require bread for survival, and it can't be left solely to the whims of the merchants who might speculate in it. So they tightly controlled prices. And those were swept away with Adam Smith. But there's still that idea that's present, that food is somehow different, and that somehow we have a right to it. That has affected the history of food riots, which we discuss in the book. Back in the early 20th century, there were extensive food riots in New York City due to what people saw as speculation in food prices. So the housewives of Manhattan went out onto the streets and were beating people up and waving placards because they were angered at what they saw as price manipulation by the people who controlled the stores. So there is a very, very fundamental ethical element to food that I think people respond to very viscerally.
We're talking about the book Empires of Food by Evan Fraser and Andrew Remus. We have both authors of this book with us this morning, and a chance for you to talk with them. We have more callers waiting, and we can take some emails as well, talk@wpr.org. And I probably have several pages of questions we'll never get to. We could easily have done 2 hours, I think, on this topic, which is a very interesting one. At any rate, the program will continue, and we'll be taking more calls in just a moment. First, though, I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of WPR. It's 10:41. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week and next week. Here's what's coming up next hour. Is tomato blight a problem in your garden? Well, after 11, Larry Miller talks with a plant pathologist about diseases affecting your vegetables this summer. Well, I guess that kind of fits in with our food theme here in this hour. This hour, of course, we're talking about the book Empires of Food, Feast, Famine, and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations by Evan Fraser and Andrew Remus, both of whom are with us by telephone this morning. Before we go back to the phones, though, there's a question I wanted to get into because I thought it was a real interesting piece of the book. You talk about a changing definition for the term glutton, and I wanted to talk about that. And Andrew, why don't you start, and then Professor Fraser, go ahead and jump in.
Certainly, we discuss what we call the new gluttony in the book, and this is, I think, something that everyone's very aware of. It's often the term foodie fits into it. We prefer the term new gluttony because it gives a bit of a historic perspective. It used to be considered back throughout much of history that overeating was something that's wrong. Overeating is a sin. And yet, nowadays, while overeating is still considered obviously morally questionable or at least socially questionable, there is an increasing movement in this country of people taking a real interest in the pleasure of their food, the daintiness, the provenance, the imported cheese, particularly the $40 plate of sea bass at a restaurant. Kobe beef is a wonderful example, and this indulgence in
pleasures of the table is something that goes back to the older definition of gluttony, which included, as well as overeating, an over-enjoyment of a daintiness, an emphasis on the new and on the gourmet. Now, we think one of the things that, about the new gluttony, which I think is wonderful and is certainly a fantastic trend in our society, is that it's educating people as they take an interest in the specificities of what they eat at a restaurant. They learn more and more about the subject of food and about the issues that surround it. And that's great. On the slightly negative side, or sometimes very negative, that also means that there can be they approach food with a fairly wasteful point of view. Again, Kobe beef being a wonderful example. If you ship a steak over from Japan to be eaten in Wisconsin, you are not really doing particularly well in terms of sustainability. It is an egregious use of resources. On the other hand, the people who are educated enough or are educated about food to want to experience this very often will have we'll learn about organics, we'll learn about inputs, we'll learn about food miles, and that is an overall positive because the more people take an interest in food and start to treat it with the same enthusiasm that perhaps they might apply to sports or pop culture or politics or whatnot, perhaps the sooner we'll see some bigger changes overall. So, Evan, do you want to add anything?
No, I think that sums it up. On one hand, we've got these great trends towards educated consumers. On the other hand, we've got sort of an excessive daintiness about our food, which, as Andrew notes, in ancient times would have been seen as morally questionable and morally wrong, on par with overeating.
Now, I think Slow Food, the organization, is a wonderful example of combining the ideas of both enjoying your food and perhaps, and then taking an interest in its background and its meaning. That's an organization which has done an awful lot to educate people about sustainability and about the energy inputs within what they're eating. Yet it does so through the heritage charcuterie plate, through the recipe for a particular Italian soup, and through enjoyment, people are becoming politically educated in that as well.
Let's take another call. We'll go to Janet in La Crosse for our next caller. Janet, good morning.
Yes, hi, it's Janice, but that's fine. Thank you, John, and your guests. I mean, two things I want to say. I saw a documentary called The Future of Our Food, and it was amazing, where you see these big corporations like Monsanto and Conagra spraying these huge fields of corn, you know, and it looks like corn, you know. How is this? There's not one living thing on there, and the corn is so chemically adulterated that it's tasteless, you know. They've done this to tomatoes, strawberries, you name it, and that's what bothers me today is that, you know, you need to go organic or locally grown things, you know. As my mother was a farmer, she said organic was when we went out the back door in our garden and got the food, you know. And fortunately, we live in this country where we could do that, or at least locally buy. But that was just amazing how they've adulterated the corn. And, of course, cows eat the corn, and it's a complete cycle. We all eat this stuff. And, we wonder, it's tasteless. It's horrible. Then the second thing is, too, then on the opposite side of that is that, okay, now you've got things like overfishing, wastefulness. How much we waste in this country, not including the ingredients, what this chemical stuff that we've been imbibing all this time, this tasteless food, this fructose, and we wonder why they're all obese, because there is no taste. You just keep eating and get fat. Thank you.
Thanks, Janice, for the call. Professor, you want to respond to that?
Sure. I mean, to me, and this is sort of almost to misquote the slow food movement, food is about three things. It's about health, it's about taste, and it's about community. And properly managed, a food system should hit all three of those things. And I grew up on a farm probably not unlike the one that Janice is describing. And yeah, we did go out the backyard, and the corn was, without any question, far superior, as were the tomatoes and melons. And we had health, we had taste, and we had community based on the vegetable garden and the farmer's market. And that, for a North American urbanite, I think is the model that we all need to be keeping in our minds, and moving ourselves in slow incremental steps away from the hypermarket kind of model. Now, we're not going to do it overnight. We're so embedded in the giant supermarket that you have to drive to in the suburb that these things aren't going to happen instantly, but slow, bit by bit, we have to start making that part of our daily routine once again, where it was part of our grandparents' daily routine.
Let's go next to Kurt in Springbrook. Good morning, Kurt.
Good morning. Yeah, I'd like to point to Daniel Quinn's work, specifically his Ishmael trilogy. And he brought up two points that's always stuck with me, and that is, first of all, our overpopulation problem is based on we've overproduced food. There's enough food to feed the people, and that's why our population is increasing. It's just like any other species in the biological community. When you increase their food supply, you're going to see an increase in population. Humans are no different. So I don't think it's a matter of us being more ethical or moral. We just have to find a way to stop overproducing food. And secondly, he points to the North American continent, the tribes that lived here, they weren't overproducing food. They were they had a very different view of the world. I mean, they didn't see the world as their food and their food's food. So I'd like to hear your guest talk about those two points.
Andrew, why don't you start on this?
Well, historically, most food empires have pushed their limits as far as they could to produce more and more. And obviously, yes, the population grows when more food is produced. And certainly what we're going through now is we do have enough food to feed 6 billion people, and we're continuing to produce more and more due to the technological fixes of artificial fertilizers and super crops and of very productive plants. But the question is, what will happen? Obviously, our population growth will match our food supply, yet we're going to hit a wall at some point. And we're already in the past 10 years, we've seen a number of years where our food supply has not met up with the increasing with the numbers that we've seen in the past. So, Evan, I mean, I think you could jump in with some of the specifics on the numbers there as to the past 10 years of the global food supply. But
I mean, just appreciate your comment, Kurt. And I mean, I'm a big fan of those Ishmael books that you referred to at the beginning of your comment, and they're indeed close to my heart as a nice encapsulation of the way the world ought to be or could be. As Andrew just pointed out, however, we have 6 billion people, we're currently growing, and we are, in at least 5 of the last 10 years, have eaten more than we have produced. The last 2 years, 2008-2009, have actually been very productive, thank goodness. We're not quite sure whether 2010 will be yet, depends on how the rains are in the Midwest in the next month and how the corn crop comes in. But we have had a number of years where food supplies, food reserves have dwindled. And my worry with the sort of the romanticization of the tribes and the work that Daniel Quinn and Ishmael talks about is that we have to manage a transition period. It's just not simply a matter of producing less food and then the population problem will go away, because if we produce less food leading to a population problem going away, that obviously implies a massive famine. And that is an ethical problem. Famine is preventable. Famine is avoidable. We just have to manage this situation, so that we don't hit what Andrew says is a brick wall and we have some sort of soft landing. I've spent the last 7 years living in the United Kingdom, and there's been all this talk about trying to create a soft landing in the housing market, and because the housing prices were growing too fast every year. And again, we need to find the brakes to create a soft landing for our system. And for the urban North American, I think it means embracing local food and farmers markets. For the African, it involves probably subsidizing fertilizer use so that they can increase their yields in areas where the soils inherently are very, very unfertile. And we need to manage this to create a soft landing. And I'm worried that the Ishmael sort of model gets this idea that we could just turn the clock back to some pre-industrial romantic period. And that would involve a lot of suffering I'm concerned about.
And there probably wouldn't be any talk show hosts either.
Or academics writing about food.
Yeah. So I don't mean to make light of this. We're getting to the end of the program. And one of the things that that you do say in your book, though, is that even if the local food movement really takes off and it's gaining some momentum, that may not be enough. And that we could be headed for the cliff. What's going to happen if we continue to go down the path that we're on now? That's question one. And then the second question that's a follow to that is, what do we do about it? And Professor, why don't you start with that, and then Andrew, just jump right in.
Okay. Well, I'll start off. That's the million-dollar question. And if we had the answer to that, we would be well on the way to a solution. What would happen? Worst-case scenario. Protracted bad drought simultaneously hits the U.S. and North China. China decides to start buying up huge quantities of wheat. The U.S., Canada, and the Ukraine decide to hoard it. Africa and the Middle East go very hungry, and that precipitates large-scale migration patterns. That would be the sort of nightmare, doomsday, Malthusian, apocalyptic scenario. And I think all it would take to realize that scenario is, say, 3 or 4 bad years simultaneously in the grain belt of the U.S. and North China plains. What can we do about it? Well, at a consumer level, we have to start at consumer level in North America, local food, farmers markets, that sort of thing. We also have to work with politicians to make sure that when we do trade food, the price that people are paying for food actually reflects the cost of the inputs, the cost on the environment, a respectable, dignified wage for the farm workers that are producing it. And so there's a strong role for regulation. And then in terms of business has to play a role in terms of getting into and making these things like organic, free, fair trade, slow food, making these part of the business model. And between those three things, a bit of regulation, a bit of consumer advocacy, and a bit of corporate self-interest that streamlines these systems, these labeling systems, I think we'll aim for that soft landing that I was speaking of a minute ago.
And also regarding food security, we really ought to start storing away for a drought, storing away for the tough times to come. So it would make a sense from a policy standpoint to for governments to start investing in more food storage in the event of some really series of rough years. That would be a buffer for the future.
So we need to take Joseph's advice to the Pharaoh of Egypt and store up grain for 7 bad years.
Kind of makes sense, yes.
Yeah. And luckily, we don't have to rely on God telling the Pharaoh through a dream that we're going to have the bad years coming. We've got pretty good, not perfect, but pretty good computer models suggesting that there are going to be bad years coming. And we don't need Joseph and divine revelation to decide we need to store the food.
Well, we've already got some signs that the wheels are starting to wobble, if not fall off. I mean, you mentioned earlier, Professor, Russia is in the midst of a record drought in some parts of the country, while massive rains in the Ukraine have depressed crop yields there. Vietnamese rice production is way off due to some climate issues. We already talked about China importing wheat from Canada. We've had some flooding in the Midwest and elsewhere that may affect crop yields this year. The list goes on. What you've said in your book, our food system is based on some rather fragile foundations, and if we lose even one leg of this table, it could tip right over on us.
Yeah, well, that's a good summary there, John. I wish it were otherwise.
Okay. Can you point us, Andrew, point us to some resources people could, in addition to your book, which I personally recommend, point us to some resources, maybe a website or two that people could look at if they want more information on the things we've talked about today?
Well,
anything come to mind quickly?
Yeah, of course. Anything regarding slow food is usually useful. I would also suggest checking out anything regarding fair trade or just
type in the word local farms and local food markets.
And if you're interested in the mathematically, statistically inclined listeners are interested in where to get production statistics and how much food the world is producing, the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO.org, has a very, very complete online database.
FAO.org, okay.
FAO.org, Food and Agriculture Organization.org, FAO.org.
We've got it. Thank you both for an interesting hour. I had two more pages of questions. I read too much. I would love to have you both back on again and talk some more about this. We did have some calls we couldn't get to either. This is a huge topic and probably deserves a lot more consideration than just 54 minutes. But thanks to both of you for being here and for your book as well.
Thank you very much, John.
The book is Empires of Food, Feast, Famine, and the Rise and Fall of Civilization, published by Free Press. Written by Evan Fraser and Andrew Remus. Rhonda Fanning produced this program. Rhonda Fanning and Dave Potras handled on-air production. If you missed a portion, if you'd like to hear either one of the 2 hours from this morning, go to our website, WPR.org. Click on Kathleen Dunn's program, and you can listen to both hours all over again. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Larry Mueller is next on the Ideas Network of WPR.